Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. And of course, we have to begin by saying go Hawks. They did a fantastic job yesterday, whether you watch football or not. It was a fun day. And we've got a fun hour coming up for you right now. Coming up in just under 20 minutes, Carlin Eggers has written more than 50 books, and more than two dozen of those have hit the New York Times, the USA Today, and Publishers Weekly bestseller lists. And she's joining us for the second time, this time to discuss Cyderbrook, her latest novel in the Swift River Valley series. And we'll end today's show with award-winning journalist John P. Davidson, who's written an intriguing novel. Really intriguing. It's based on a true story. It's of something that not many people know about. He spent 10 years researching this and decided to write a fiction story about it. And he's coming up around 12:40 today. And the book is basically about a guy who discovers that his life was nothing but a facade, carefully constructed by his mother and her lover, both of whom were Soviet agents who were loyal to Stalin. But first, I'm very pleased to have with us Jennifer Loudon. First, Annie Dillard said many years ago, how we spend our days is how we spend our lives. And we're going to take a look at that today with Jennifer Loudon's heart-based, spirit-directed approach to fitting it all in. She is the author of The Life Organizer and The Woman's Comfort Book. She's a personal growth pioneer and has written four additional books on well-being and whole living, as well as leading many retreats, and has inspired women around the world through her work. She believes that self-love plus world love equals wholeness for all, and we'll find out more about that in a moment. Jennifer Loudon, welcome to the show.
Well, you know, I call myself a personal growth pioneer because I've been doing it for so long.
Well, you have. You've been around a long time. You were one of the first people out there doing this.
Yeah, it's a nice way to say I'm getting old.
And well, you're local to the Northwest up here, so you're enjoying this beautiful weather with us today.
I know we shouldn't have it. It probably means that we're going to have a drought, but it sure is a nice for a change to see the sky.
Right, right, it is. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. It's The Life Organizer, A Woman's Guide to a Mindful Year. And it's full of tips, stories, and prompts to focus your needs and navigate your dreams. There are a lot of self-help books out there, a lot of books about managing our time and trying to fit things in. But this is a little different. You say it's not just about time management. That's only half the picture. There's a whole other part of us that withers if we're not making time to listen and tune in. And so tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, we all know that life is rich and somewhat overwhelming, or life at different times in our life sometimes has so much time in it that we have to choose how to direct our time. And it's easy for life to become something we're reacting to. And it, the end of the day comes, and day after day, and we kind of go, what was that? You know, wow, I ticked a lot of things off my list, but I feel kind of empty and restless. Or, oh, I really wanted to work on my book, or, you know, speaking of the novelist or coming on after myself, or I really wanted to paint, or I really wanted to, you know, even organize the photographs, but I didn't get to it again. So my book is trying to help people do that, but in this tiny step-by-step way, because that's how change really happens.
Right. And why did you become interested in this kind of work?
My daughter, who is now 19 at the University of Washington, go dogs, was about two, and I was publishing and speaking and traveling around the country, teaching, and I thought I was going to be pulled into 17,000 pieces. I felt guilty and stretched between parenting and my work that was calling to me, and I was really having some incredible success. And I wanted to weigh, you know, I tried the Stephen Covey method, and I tried, you know, lots of appointments and scheduling time for myself, and none of it was working. So I said, there must be a way to use my intuition, my inner knowing to balance this out, a more feminine way.
Mm.
I still use a calendar.
Right.
But I knew there was another, I knew I was, something else was calling to me.
Right. It's really funny that this came across my desk at this time, because this book's been out a long time, hasn't it?
It has. This is a new version. We edited, I got to edit it slightly and update it a little bit, and it just came out in paperback. But the original versions of it have been around for 15 years.
Yeah.
I published it in lots of different forms. Yeah.
Well, it's very nice. I mean, it's very colorful and just like a book that you want to keep on a side table.
Yes.
But it's very fortuitous that it hit my desk, because my life this year, my goal this year is all about integration, because I feel I've had to compartmentalize so many aspects of my life, literally just to get through the day sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to integrate more this year. And, you know, it really has. You say this, it's become a badge of honor in our society. You know, you talk to ask anyone how they're doing, and they don't say, well, I'm really good. Very often they go, I'm so busy. And this is a way for us to really get out of that and really think and be mindful about what we're doing.
Yes, I call it bringing down the Berlin Wall of busyness. For those of us who were old enough to remember the Berlin Wall. And because it really is, when you think about being being addicted to or supporting the narrative, the cultural narrative of story, 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 busy, 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 the busy, busy, busy story, we fall asleep to what's most important. And we aren't going to be able to solve the problems that are facing us as a species if we don't slow down.
That's very true. So I want to talk a little bit about resistance, Jennifer, because many self-help experts say resistance is not a good thing and we need to let go of it. I have a slightly different take on that, because I think it's telling us something's wrong. And you talk about, well, you tell us in your own words what you say about resistance, because you don't think it's necessarily a bad thing either.
Well, I have this really new perspective on resistance, and it's in the book a little bit, but here's the cutting edge thought. I think when resistance is present, even something silly like resistance to doing our taxes, it's actually pointing to something more that we want. Now, that more could be, you know, I want to know that my financial life is in order. That's what I really want. But we focus on the resistance. We focus and we make ourselves wrong and we get into a war with it. And so what I coach women to do is to look around. I mean, I literally do this. I look around the room of my studio and I go, what more do I want? So this resistance is here kind of stopping me, making me afraid, making it seem really difficult. But instead of focusing on that, what more do I want? Maybe I mentioned creating before, you know, getting to that painting or that writing. What more I want is that creative flow. And I can pay attention to that, put my attention there, speaking of being mindful, instead of on the resistance.
Right, right. So you have a practice that you say that when you're feeling stuck, you're digging in, you're leaning back on your heels with your arms folding and not wanting to move. You ask yourself, what's the more I want? Talk us through that process, that thought process.
So I have, you know, every day as a knowledge worker, I have lots of resistance to sitting down and doing the creative hard work. It requires cognitive resources. It's scary. I might not do it well. So resistance is very much present in my studio. But so what I do when I sit down is I acknowledge it. It's here. I'm resisting being creative. I'm resisting doing this work, even though I really love it. But I don't make the resistance bad. I don't make me wrong, which is one of the places that many of us get stopped and stuck. We get lost in beating ourselves up. And from a neurobiological point of view, it's just such bad news. It so demoralizes
mm-hmm.
us. That's our willpower. So I just say, hey, resistance is in the house. Welcome. And I mean, I really do like to have a little sense of humor about it. And then I lean back in my chair here, take a couple of breaths, bring the body in a little bit, not just a giant head here. And I say, hey, what more do I really want to experience right now? What more am I hungry for? What more am I desiring? And in this case, it's, I really want that connection with this material. I'm teaching a class online right now. I really want to dig in. I want to create what's great for my students. That's the more I want. And then I let that draw me or pull me into working. it really is where we put our attention.
Yeah. And I love that you say you're known as the queen of the comfort queen. And I love that you say that, you know, instead of going to an expert, it's really about coming into this moment and owning it for myself.
Oh, gosh. You know, I believe that self-trust is the one of the top skills that we need to develop as women. And we live in a time where it's never been easier to click away from ourselves and look to an expert or a celebrity. You know, if you can have one practice to take away from this interview, the next time you're worried or wondering about how to do something or whether to do something, stop, take a nice, just delicious breath, relax your shoulders away from your ears, put your hand on your heart, remember a time that you were feeling so strong, and then ask yourself, what do I know about this? You may not hear anything. You may be like, I have no idea. Go ahead and research.
Right, right.
Ahead and ask somebody else, but at least get in the habit of asking yourself first.
Yeah, I think that's so true. We, you know, so many people do tend to go ask other people and experts or read a book or a magazine and say, well, they said this without really thinking if, you know, what they said fits our world and our situation.
Yeah.
And you're all about authenticity. And, you know, you mentioned a book that palliative care nurse wrote. If I can just find her name, you probably know it.
It's Ronnie. Oh, gosh, what's her last name? I just forgot. As soon as you said it, I'm like, oh, yes, I know it. And then I didn't.
Yeah, but she wrote a book about the people who were dying and asked them what was the one thing that they most regretted. And it was that they did not live an authentic life and basically lived life for somebody else.
Yes, that they lived the life that they thought they were expected to live.
Yeah.
And so Bronnie Ware, right, exactly.
The Five Regrets of the Dying is the book.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Faster on the Google than I am. So when you think about it, our true life, the life that we crave, the life that we desire, the life we want to craft, it's happening right here today. It's not happening in our resolutions that we maybe made and already broke for the year. It's not happening in our big five-year plan. It's not happening when we get the promotion or have the baby or publish the book and get on Oprah. That was a lesson I had to learn. It's happening here in this moment, the choices that we're making. And can we make them with more mindfulness and self-trust, which doesn't mean they're going to turn out right. There just means they were ours.
Right. Well, you just mentioned Oprah. I want to ask you about that because you say that you worked your butt off to get on on the Oprah show. And as you left her stage, you felt you'd sold yourself out, which was a great lesson to you. What happened?
Well, what happened was I was on for a segment about women who were afraid to eat alone. And I remember I wrote a book called The Woman's Retreat Book. And I got to talk about retreats and the power of retreats, but it was framed in this kind of, for me, it was sort of a shallow way. But I agreed to do that. And I agreed to do that because without me knowing, it just took a lot of learning afterwards, I was hoping that being on Oprah would make me feel like I was enough. Right? We all have this story we live in. Once I get married, once I get the house,
once I
get the permit, I'll be enough. But then that arrives. And if we haven't been building it in from the inside out, in that self-trust we were talking about, it's so empty. So nothing against Oprah, totally me.
Right.
Like walking off the stage going, crap, why doesn't this feel good? Oh, because I should have said, no, I don't want to talk about women who don't want to eat alone. I don't care about women who don't want to eat alone. I care about my ideas. And yes, let's talk about it in a way that's helpful to people and build a bridge to them. But this felt silly to me. But I said yes. Because I wanted someone to tell me I was good enough.
Yeah. Well, as you said, a valuable life lesson.
Yes.
And I have to let you go in a minute, but I want to ask you this, because I know you're a fan of Brené Brown's work. Daring Greatly is one of her books. She talks about shadow comforts and time monsters. Mm. You talk about those. You say that when we choose either of those shadow comforts or time monsters, we choose less aliveness, desire, creativity, connection, less of our true life. Just give us a final thought on that, if you would.
Well, Brené loved that concept so much when she learned it from me because it relates to how we shame ourselves. So shadow comforts are the things that we do instead of what we really want to do to nurture ourselves. It's not what we do, it's how it makes us feel. Do you eat the chocolate because you want it and you're tasting it, or do you eat it because you want to numb yourself out? You want to cut yourself off from what's difficult but alive. Same thing with time monsters. Are you working on that painting you really want to paint, or are you suddenly spending 3 days getting the perfect flyer ready for your kid's carnival?
And we all do that.
We all do that. Yes, absolutely. Everyone, even the Dalai Lama, he says, don't drive me by electronic stores.
I remember cleaning a floor with practically a toothbrush once when I was trying to avoid studying for my stockbroker's license.
Yes. And so again, we just bring a lot of curiosity and some of the tools in the book, and we begin to have a relationship with those choices, not making them wrong or saying we'll never do them again, but, here I am reaching for the toothbrush to clean the grout. Maybe I'll just take a breath, and I'll ask myself, what do I really want? And the answer may be, I really want to have that license, but I don't want to study for it. But even that is information. It inches you forward into your true life.
Right. And ultimately, I took the license, but I did not follow the path.
Yes. And that happens to all of us. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, Jennifer Loudon, I want to thank you for being with us, the Life Organizer. It's a new book offering, it's not new. It's been around a while, but it's been touched up and rewritten a little. And it offers heart-based, spirit-directed approach to fitting it all in. It's a fun book. Thank you for being with us today, Jennifer.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
And again, the book is called The Life Organizer, A Woman's Guide to a Mindful Year. And you can find out more about Jennifer and the fantastic work she's doing at jenniferloudon.com, jenniferloudon.com. All right, please stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Carla Negus, New York Times bestselling author of Ciderbrook. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out why Roberta Chinsky-Matchison is known as the talent maximizer and how her techniques can help identify great talent for your business and how to showcase your own unique talents. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking now with Carla Negus. She's joining us for the second time on Conversations Live. And for those of you who heard her before, you might remember that she's actually been spinning stories since she climbed a tree with a pad and a pen at the age of 11. She's now got millions of copies of her books in print in more than 30 countries, and more than two dozen of her 60-plus books have been placed on the New York Times, USA Today, and Publishers Weekly bestsellers. Cyderbrook is the third novel in her acclaimed Swift River Valley romantic mystery series that launched with The Secrets of the Lost Summer and That Night on Thistle Lane. Secrets of the Lost Summer spent 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and garnered rave reviews. And I'm pleased to have you back today. Carlyn Eggers, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you again.
So, well, you've been busy. You're always busy, right?
It's been a very busy few months, I have to say. But great.
Is there ever a time when you are not writing the next book?
You know, I write a lot. I love to write, so that's a good thing. But there are times, you know, I take breaks. I love to have a time where I can just, I love to walk, so I'll walk the Irish Hills, or we've been actually, we went out to the Cotswolds in England for the first time,
and then
I live in Vermont, and I just walk and walk and walk and let things just percolate. I call that the discovery time, where you're just not really consciously working on a book, but anything can happen.
Yeah, I love that time when you can just let your mind go kind of blank and it just wanders off by itself.
Yeah, and there's no, like, I have to think about this scene or I have to solve this particular plot problem or, gee, I don't know what to do in chapter 7. None of that stuff is going on in my mind. I'm just walking and trying to be fully present in the moment, which also helps because then you don't trip over things, right?
Right. That's very true. Yeah. Well, I remember from last time we talked how much you liked Ireland, and I believe it was the Scotch as well, the Irish whiskey. But
that's right. Yes. We talked about my Sharp and Donovan series, and that's a suspense series. So that's a fun one. And in fact, I'm finishing up Harbor Island now, which is the next book in that series. So it's a lot of fun for me to have two very different series going on. That's FBI agents, and it's set in Boston, Southern Maine, and Ireland, pretty much. And then I have the Swift River Valley series, and Cyderbrook is part of that, and it's just brand new out. And it's set in a small town on the western edge of the Quabbin Reservoir, which is, if you look at a map of New England and go to southern New England and Massachusetts, you'll see right in the middle of Massachusetts is this big body of water. You go, okay, what is that doing there? Well, it used to be an area of the Swift River, and three branches of the Swift River flowed through this valley of four small towns and these little villages. And in about 75 years ago, the state took over this property, this whole valley, and dammed up the river and creating, it's Windsor Dam and Goodnow Dyke, and creating the reservoir because the river then was allowed to, flood. So the whole valley is flooded and everybody in the valley had to go. And there's these little towns still on the edges of the reservoir. And I grew up in one of those towns. And so eventually I created Little Knight's Bridge, which is a fictional town on this reservoir, and populated it with people and secrets and things going on.
Yes, lots of things going on. Bad boy firefighters, for what?
Yes, you know, it's like I see bad boy firefighter, and I'm like, okay, I'm with you, I'm going. So this is our Justin Sloan. He's a volunteer firefighter and kind of a taciturn guy, too, but he's always lived in this little town of Knightsbridge. And he's a bit of a dreamer and adventurer at heart, but he doesn't necessarily talk about all that stuff. Well, he owns this old cider mill on Cider Brook. It's a 19th century abandoned falling down cider mill. And if you pick up a copy of Cider Brook or go to my website or Amazon or wherever and look at the cover, it's a very beautiful cover with this gorgeous cider mill on it. Well, that's what he'd like to turn this one into, but it's kind of falling down. But he just has always wanted, so he owns it. He's not sure what he's going to do with it. But he's a carpenter, so he'll figure something out. But it catches fire, and who should be in it but our treasure hunter, Samantha Bennett.
Right, and she begins with a tall story told by her grandfather. And I read that your father was a Dutch sailor and obviously traveled a lot, and sailors are known for their tall stories. I'm wondering if you got some of your storytelling ability from your dad.
Oh, absolutely. My father was such a character. He Dutch, and he went off to sea at 14 and then again at 17.
Wow.
And he then during World War II, he was at sea kind of fighting on these merchant marine, he was a gunner on these merchant marine ships out of England. And so he, you know, he had quite many, many adventures while his family was in Holland. And so and he had a big, big, big family. So by the time the war was over, he came home and things were not great. And he ended up emigrating to the States, and two more brothers followed. So you can imagine all the stories associated with that, that time at sea between the war and then, being a merchant marine after the war and stuff. So yes, he would tell stories, and then a lot of funny stories. I think, and then later in his life, we heard some of the sadder stories. But there were many, many adventures, and he was a good guy. So it was really, and it was fun to imagine that, because by the time, you know, he started to have a family, all that was behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up in this little town, in Swift River Valley, and. And that's kind of the long story of how he ended up there. But I, as a kid, would be imagining what his life was like before he moved it, when he was sailing the seven seas, so to speak, when he was growing up as a little Dutch boy, you know, and he would tell stories about canals and skating and, you know, some of these classic things. And it was just fun to imagine and picture that. And I think that helped me to become a writer.
Yeah, it's great to have these people in our lives. I remember one of my grandfathers did not talk very much, but when we all got together at holidays, all the stories would start coming out. He was in World War One and Black Watch in World War Two. And so we'd have this family joke, the stories get better every year, you know.
I know, we're trying to piece together some of the stories. You know, there's this before the war, he would do a run to Argentina and back on his sailing ship, and so it was you know, the different stories that he had in Argentina, and we would as kids, you know, we would compare notes, mm-hmm. of who was around when he told the story, to see how whether it all held up or whether it changed. So it's really, you know, and now that he's gone, I have my oldest brother is actually writing some stories based on that. But imagining and being at sea, you know, I like adventures and I love to do things, but the idea of being on this ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is just like oh, and the things that can happen out there. So
yeah.
So it was natural for me to have Cider Brook involve pirates. So, it, you know, you just take and say, well, and then a treasure hunter who likes to is searching for sunken ships and treasures,
yes.
Buried treasure on land. And that's what Samantha Bennett is. And she has her grandfather, who was an adventurer and told her stories about exploring the Antarctic, and she just knows she's never going to do that. I'm not going to do that. But she has her own adventures and creates her own mission and her own purpose. And so I knew that I was never going to be a merchant marine, you know, or a head gunner during World War II. You know, these things are not going to
not
in my cards. So I think those things are interesting when you think as a writer. You know, you're making up something from whole cloth, but then you drill it down and you realize, oh, there's these little threads back to this or that, and in this case, to my father.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Well, Samantha Bennett, your female protagonist, has somewhat of an iffy past. As a writer, how did you incorporate that and still make her a likable character?
Well, I think it all boils down to motivation, and she, her past, it's really, it's not so bad. You know, there's iffy, and then there's I got fired, you know? She has this mentor who's was a very well respected treasure hunter, and I mean it's kind of a funny term, but he really worked hard to maintain his reputation. And so 2 years ago, before Cider Brook starts, she had come to Little Knightsbridge because she had this whole theory that a pirate 300 years ago buried treasure in this area, in this general area, and maybe the treasure never was there, maybe it was there. Maybe it's under the reservoir. She doesn't know. And And she doesn't tell this guy about that, and he felt entitled to know. So she kind of left something out. And then he died shortly after he fired her. So she never got a chance to redeem herself. So now it's 2 years later, and she has some new information, and she sneaks. She thinks that she's just going to sneak into Knightsbridge, you know, figure things out, be able to prove this mystery, this about this 300, you know, this pirate who was there, she believes, 300 years ago, and that will kind of redeem her. But things go awry from like the minute she lands in Knightsbridge.
Yeah. Well, romance reviews, long and short reviews, says her characters, your characters, are believable and she perfectly captures her signature backdrop of New England, painting a distinct picture of the charm and allure New England is abundantly infamous for. So your backdrop, your landscape becomes another character, and that's very true of your books.
I think so. And this area, the Swift River Valley, the Quabbin Valley, and the surrounding towns, just lends itself to being kind of a character because of the just how they ended up in existence, and then what's happened when you have such a change where they come in and a whole mm-hmm. whole town were depopulated, and you have that people had to go somewhere, so they go into the surrounding towns. And then how everything changed because of that. So you have this little town, and I just love little towns anyway. But I grew up in one. I live in one. I had my Boston stint, but I love small towns and small town life. So creating my own town and populating it with secrets and then having it in New England in an area that I know so well, and that has such a rich history. And that infuses the story. I mean, they're not historical novels or anything like that. I do take Secrets of the Lost Summer. We go back to the 1930s, and there's quite a story about a woman who's now in her 90s, and she, got involved with a jewel thief in the 30s, and so now there's the whole mystery around the stolen jewels and where are they and what happened to them, and that brings that treasure hunter who dies in before the stories all start, but his son comes to town.
Mm-hmm.
But he had come to town before that trying to find that, and he bought a piece of property, and that changes the whole town just because of his one visit, and how that can happen too in anywhere, or in our lives. But here we have this little town where the stranger comes to town and changes the destiny of so many people within that town.
Mm. Well, before we let you go today, we talked a little bit about how you take time off to think. But as far as your schedule, you say you have two mottos. One is from the Tao, let life ripen and fall. Force is not the way at all. And the other one is one you say you heard from a friend, anxiety focuses the mind.
Right. That's when the Tao doesn't work, you know?
But when the Tao doesn't work.
Yeah, it's those are definitely two mottos that I for better or for worse. You know, I'm in the anxiety focuses the mind mode now. So, but that's really a funny way of saying that when I'm writing, when I first start a book, everything is just nice and orderly, and I let things kind of, I go on the long walks, I come and I sit down for a while, and the book sort of starts to take shape. And then by the time I get to finishing up the whole book, I describe it as like on the tip of my tongue. And that's when I can just work on it, 24/7, but I got to sleep. So that's where I say anxiety focuses the mind, but really what it is, it's just a part of my creative process.
Yes, I understand that.
But anxiety works too, you know, when they say, I'm coming for it. I'm coming for the manuscript. No, it's really loads of fun, but it is when that whole, it can be whatever you're doing, really, some creative process where it's like, now I know, I have the whole thing. I know what it is, whether it's you're sewing or you're doing a craft or you're doing a poem or you're doing an article for something or a blog or whatever. And now I just got it, and I just got to get it done. And when it's, of course, it's a 400-page manuscript, it you can't do it all in 5 minutes.
Right.
It does take some time.
No, I totally understand that percolation, that space time, and then it's like it just this feeling comes over you, and that's it.
Yeah, I heard an author describe it as I can't remember what the author was, but she described it as like a coalescing, and then the tornado touches the ground.
You know? Love it.
And off she goes with it.
Well, Colin Eggers, thanks for being with us today. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I hope readers will enjoy Ciderbrook and visit me on my website, carlineggers.com. And, you know, I'm always on Facebook and Twitter and around and about and love to hear from readers.
Great. Thank you so much. Colin Eggers and the book again, Ciderbrook, which is the third in the Swift River Valley series. Thanks for being with us, Carla. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back with award-winning journalist John P. Davidson, who's written a fascinating novel based on 10 years of historical research. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, we'll educate mostly the human-animal, relationship whisperer, and co-author of Are You Still Kissing Frogs, Shauna Rosewood, joins us in the studio. She'll share her tips on how to attract a perfect committed partner to you, and her techniques apply to attracting almost anything. Call for coaching or with questions, Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and I'm very pleased to welcome now award-winning journalist John P. Davidson, who's written a really great novel. It is beautifully written. John P. Davidson began writing at Texas Monthly Magazine, where one of his early assignments was to follow Mexicans crossing the Rio Grande to find jobs in Texas. That sounds pretty dangerous to me. He made the trip himself twice, resulting in the book The Long Road North, and has held senior editorial positions at Texas Monthly, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Vanity Fair. He's written also for GQ, Fortune, Rolling Stone, Harper's, the list goes on. And he's received a National Endowment for the Arts grant and has been a guest lecturer at the University of the Americas in Mexico. John P. Davidson, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. It's nice to be on with you.
Well, this is a very intriguing book, so... almost don't know where to start with it, but what I would like to do is it started with 10 years of research. So let's go back and just begin with how the idea for this story started to evolve for you.
Oh, sure. I was in Mexico City, I guess it was about 12 years ago, and I was staying in Coyoacan, which is once a village. It's sort of a suburb of the city. It's where the Frida Kahlo Museum is and where the Trotsky House is, the Trotsky House Museum. And I had some time, and so I went to the Kahlo House, and then I went over to the Trotsky House. And as I walked through the museum, it's a very dramatic place. There's still bullet holes in the walls. It has a very, very strong vibe that's very alive there. And and I began to wonder, why don't I just know this story about Trotsky? Why is this such a mystery to me? And, I mean, I knew who Trotsky was, but the story of the assassination. And I thought about it, and then I thought, it's even stranger because I'd been to the museum before, and I realized that when I went before, it was before the fall of the Soviet Union. It was, and I think that I had been so indoctrinated during the Cold War that I was unable to see these people as. I was unable to see their basic humanity, mm-hmm. and I just wasn't receptive to the story, and that's when it started.
Right, and so the book is set in 1938, Spanish Civil War, basically socialist versus fascist.
That's correct.
And so, why did you decide? You put 10 years of research into this. Why did you decide to fictionalize it versus write a nonfiction book?
I started out writing it as nonfiction, and I did three drafts of it as nonfiction, and it went back and forth between sort of these dramatic sections and what were almost like expository or essay sections, and it wasn't working, and I finally realized that the way to do it would be to tell it from Ramon Mercader's point of view, who's the young Spaniard who's enlisted to assassinate Trotsky. And so at that point, I started over again. So all of that 10 years was not strictly research. A good bit of it was writing. And, of course, the research went on. I was researching while I was writing at the same time. Mm. But it just took a long time to get it right.
Well, yeah, I would think you have a feeling of great responsibility there. Last week, I talked with Canadian author Brian Peyton. His book was The Wind Is Not a River. And he had taken a true story of the Japanese occupation of the Aleutians in Alaska and turned that into fiction. But all of his characters were fictionalized. Your characters are really based on real people. So what kind of responsibility and how hard was it for you to actually portray them as realistically as you could?
You know, I had read about them and thought about them, and I'd done a good bit of writing before I turned to fiction, but I felt comfortable with it. I felt like I knew who these people were, and I knew less about the Stalinist. I knew less about Ramon and his mother and that side of it. So that required more imagination. But I liked it. It was an interesting process. It was and I knew so much about them. I knew what they wore. I knew what color their cars were. I knew, you know, how many packs of cigarettes they smoked a day, that sort of thing. So I had a lot of information to go on. Mm.
And I read that you found all of this information because, I mean, obviously there's not, I think there was somebody still alive from that time that you talked with, but mostly from books. You said that most people wrote books. Most people who knew these people wrote books about it.
Many did, and our books or articles. And Trotsky was a wonderful writer. He was a famous writer during his time, and his circle was literary, and in addition to being political. And so a lot of people around him wrote, and so there were the published articles and the published books. Plus, there were also. Notes that had been taken that I found at the Hoover Institute in Palo Alto.
Mm. So tell our listeners a little about Ramon, who basically was cultivated by his mother and her lover to become the assassin of Trotsky.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about Ramon.
I think that he was a fairly ordinary young man, and he wasn't an ideologue like his mother. His mother was a committed Stalinist. She was a Marxist, but he was, at the beginning of the book, he's a soldier, and his mother comes to the front and talks him into going to Paris and to infiltrate Trotsky's inner circle there. And he doesn't know that there's a possibility that he'll end up being Trotsky's assassin. And so, and he's quite angry at the beginning of the book because his brother has been killed and basically sacrificed by Stalinists to prove a point. And he's very angry at his mother that she couldn't prevent that and didn't prevent it.
Now, how did you feel yourself about Ramon after you'd done all of this research?
I started out in the beginning. I saw him strictly as this assassin. I didn't like him that much. I thought, how could you do this? How could you kill somebody in cold blood? But by the time I was finished, I was sympathetic with him. I mean, there were two different stories you would hear about him, and many of the people who knew him in Mexico, many of the people in Trotsky's circle were very drawn to him. Apparently, he was a very engaging, charming man, and one of the things he was famous for was giving, the perfect and wonderful and thoughtful gift to people. Mm-hmm. And he had wonderful manners, and he had a lot of style. And so, by the time I finished, he's the hero of the book, yeah. and the anti-hero anyway. And I think he has my sympathy.
You said in an interview I was listening to that the characters in the book, there are some characters who, are kind of in the background, shadow characters. But by the time you'd written this book, you realized that they all really played an integral role in the book. And none of them were really shadow characters. They were equally as fascinating as those in the spotlight.
Yes, true enough. In fact, Trotsky was such a monumental character, and it took me quite a while to realize that that Ramon's mother and her lover, that they were, in their own way, that they were larger than life and very, very compelling. And when you read what people around them said about them, they were they were very strong characters. Mm-hmm. And very engaged in the drama of their time.
And you mentioned Frida Kahlo earlier, the Mexican painter. So how did she feature into Ramon's existence?
Oh, it's such a good story. She and Trotsky, when Trotsky arrived in Mexico, he and his entourage, his wife and his secretaries and his American guards, lived in Trotsky's house in Coyoacan, lived in Frida's house in Coyoacan. While she wasn't there, she was living with her husband Diego Rivera, and she and Trotsky ended up having a short romance, and which Diego Rivera found out about. And then, well, Frida went to Paris for this political meeting, a Trotsky meeting, and there she met Ramon, and they had a brief sexual encounter and an evening, I believe, and then they moved in the same circles in Paris and saw each other. And then when he went to Mexico, he looked her up, and she was lived. Her house was only about four blocks from where Trotsky was, and she was fun to write. I mean, she was so vivid in her use of language and the way she dressed, and she was a great character. It was very easy to to do that part of the book.
Mm. You're an award-winning journalist. You won the Penn and Missouri Prize for Excellence in Journalism. How different is it for you to sit down and write a journalistic piece versus a fictional piece? Do you go in a different zone?
It's a different zone. It's a different way of thinking. And I think the main thing I had to become comfortable with is not knowing what's going to happen. And I guess the hardest thing with writing is you have to become comfortable with just the blank page staring at you. And in some ways, by the time I finished this, I really loved that. I really loved not knowing exactly where I was going and just finding my way.
Mm. Do you think by the time you'd done all the research and written it, do you think Trotsky knew this was coming, that this assassin was coming for him?
Yes. I mean, that's a very good question. Yes. One of the amazing things is that everyone knew that Stalin was going to have Trotsky assassinated, and he was waiting for it. He expected it. And toward the end, it's very interesting that he Trotsky basically was ignoring all of these clues that he was getting from Ramon. And he could have stopped it. All he had to do was say, you know, to tell his guards not to let Ramon in. And there was some speculation that it was something of a collaboration, that Trotsky was ready. Mm-hmm. You know, life had been mm-hmm. difficult. And I think that it must have been unconscious, that's a good question, Vicki.
Well, it's a beautifully written book, as we would expect from you, and it's called The Obedient Assassin. It's a novel based on a true story. It is really intriguing. I also very quickly just want to mention, I saw you have a cover story in Harper's Magazine, and you know, a lot of people are really hooked on Downton Abbey up here, and this
yeah.
was a story where you, I believe, were your assignment was to, you tell us.
The assignment was to go to a butler school in Denver. It was an 8-week course, and I was trained to be a butler, and I went to the school undercover, and I actually tried to find a job as a butler, but so far I haven't succeeded. because it's easier being a writer than being a novelist.
Oh dear, and that's not that easy either. So, well, John Davidson, it's been a pleasure talking with you again. The book is called The Obedient Assassin. A very quick final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I hope they'll read the book, and I hope they like it, and I hope it makes some. I wrote the book for people who didn't particularly know a lot about Trotsky or this period. And so I think it's very accessible. So I hope that people will give it a try.
Yeah. And listeners can find out more about John P. Davidson at his website, which is johnpdavidson.com. And there's also a link to that Harper's Bazaar article that we just talked about, the book The Obedient Assassin. Thanks for being with us, John. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Vicky.
And I thank all of you for joining us today and spending this hour with us. We'll be back next week with an all-new live show. And if you have comments or questions, feedback on today's show, you can find me in several places. You can find us at conversationslive.net, email info@conversationslive.net. You can also find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, which is VickiSt Clair. I say all I's, no E's. Vicky St. Clair. And you can find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. You can, did I give out the 800 number? That's 495-7617 for those of you who don't like email. 800-495-7617. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.